From the independent producer project of KCRW, this is Here Be Monsters. A quick warning to listeners, especially if there are kids nearby. This episode is largely about sexual violence towards children. Most of the descriptions scattered throughout the piece are fairly clinical, but one in particular is quite graphic and disturbing. That description comes from court tape that we recorded. So if you don't want to hear that, listen for the beginning of the court tape and then skip ahead about a minute and a half.
What is McNeil Island?
It's an island. It's in the Puget Sound. It takes about a half-hour boat ride to get out to it. It had its origins as actually a kind of a small community, had its own post office. Then they opened a federal prison there, which really kind of was when it embarked on something very different than what it used to be.
This is Andrew Morrison. He's a public defender in Washington State. Andrew often goes to McNeil Island to visit some of his clients. They live there in a facility called the Special Commitment Center.
Today, the only thing on McNeil Island is the Special Commitment Center, which is located somewhat centrally, a little bit north part of the island. Once you take your half-hour boat ride, you then take another 10 to 15-minute bus ride to get into the interior of the island where the facility is. I think it's in the range of 260-ish people that are in total confinement out on McNeil Island.
The Special Commitment Center is not a prison. It's a treatment center.
There are a couple of layers of razor wire fencing. If you were to picture it, it's got kind of a cyclone razor wire across the top. And then if you could just kind of imagine the circles of cyclone razors has special wire that is motion sensitive. So that if anyone climbs on it, then the alarm bells go off. I think it's a constant irritation to staff because the raccoons on the island tend to crawl that fence and set off the alarms. The island itself is fairly picturesque. There's all kinds of small wildlife that live out there because there's no predators at this point and very little human impact on a day-to-day basis other than this bus that is constantly driving up and down to the facility. The rest of it has really been allowed to kind of have nature take it back. When you ask me what McNeil Island is, that's, yeah. I don't know if you meant the island or if you meant the facility.
Well, I'm wondering if this is just a slip of the tongue, but you said there were no predators out there.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I'm speaking in reference to the prey animals like deer and that sort of thing.
Back in 1990, the state of Washington passed the Community Protection Act. This was the first law in the USA that gave a state the power to label certain sex offenders as sexually violent predators. For someone to meet the definition of sexually violent predator, they must suffer from a mental abnormality or personality disorder that makes them likely to engage in acts of sexual violence if not confined in a secure facility. But Andrew Morrison thinks that many of the people committed at the SCC don't actually meet that definition. And he thinks that many of the people labeled as sexually violent predator aren't actually as dangerous as they're made out to be.
These are individuals that have finished their criminal sentence, and the government wants to detain them indefinitely on a theory that they suffer from a unique kind of mental illness that makes them exceptionally dangerous. It's the complete deprivation of a person's liberty. There are individuals out there that are predatory and pose a risk to the community that they're in, but I don't believe we've got the means to identify them at the level that this law requires.
A while back, Andrew wrote an email to me and my co-producer Bethany Denton. Andrew asked us if we wanted to talk to one of his clients, a person who's been a resident of the Special Commitment Center ever since the late 90s. Bethany and I didn't know what to believe or what to expect. So of course, we took Andrew up on that offer. Here Be Monsters, the podcast about
becoming healthy people,
the podcast about
the unknown.
No. Bethany Denton and I are standing at the Steilacoom ferry dock in the South Puget Sound. It's a bright March day, and trains pass behind us on the tracks. And in front of us, off in the deep distance, the water gives way to the Olympic mountain range that separates this part of Washington from the Pacific Ocean. Some large boats come and go, and some smaller patrol boats putter around the docks. And here on the ferry dock in Steilacoom, Washington, we're standing as close to McNeil Island as we're allowed to be. We can see it there, off in the distance, a couple miles in front of us, and we can see the sun glinting off the white walls of the now abandoned prison. The Special Commitment Center is back there, just over a hill and behind a layer of trees. Bethany and I drove the 2 hours here from Seattle for just one purpose. We wanted to meet a man named Chris, and prior to this day, we'd only ever seen Chris in court. But to protect him, his family, and his victims, we're just going to call him that. We're just going to call him Chris.
My name is Chris. I have been identified by the state of Washington as an SVP. It stands for Sexually Violent Predator.
Throughout Chris's life, he's received a variety of diagnoses for mental disorders.
ADD, bipolar, Tourette's, ADHD, bipolar 2, tardive dyskinesia, antisocial personality disorder.
Some of these diagnoses came and went, and so did a regimen of psychotropic drugs meant to help calm his symptoms, including lithium, Luvox, clonidine, anafrenil, risperidol, Paxil, Cerazone, Effexor, and Tegretol.
You know, as someone who's never, you know, been prescribed those same drugs as you were on, I have a hard time imagining what that must be like. Is there any, like, kind of analogy or anything you can use to explain what that feeling was like?
Have you ever been just completely plastered drunk? You know that mental fog you get where you can't really think very far ahead, you can't really plan, you're a lot more reckless and impulsive? Well, imagine living with that fog 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, without the fun inebriation that you would get from the alcohol. Just that mental fog and a significantly reduced level of inhibition. However, they did not force me to do something. I made a choice. I chose to commit the sexual offense that I did. That is on me. I chose to abuse the people that I abused. The drugs, they played a part, but they did not make me do it. I made a choice. Those factors just made it easier to make that choice.
Chris's path to the Special Commitment Center on McNeil Island is a convoluted story, one that's written in hundreds of pages of court documents. And sometimes those documents are contradictory or confusing, with some elements that still remain unclear to us. But what we do know is this. One day, when Chris was 16, he was with a neighbor boy about 4 years younger than him. Chris pinned the boy down and either penetrated him with his penis, or he put his penis between the boy's legs. And the boy's mother found the two of them. Chris had a trial, and he was convicted of second-degree child molestation. However, through subsequent interviews and psych evaluations, Chris admitted to engaging in a long pattern of abuse towards many victims, totaling hundreds of times. His primary victims were his younger siblings. Chris served a 2-year sentence in a juvenile facility. In 1997, Chris completed his sentence and he was released on parole in Seattle. He was 18 years old. It wasn't long until King County prosecutors sought to get sexually violent predator status for Chris.
My name is Jennifer Ritchie, and I'm a King County Deputy Prosecuting Attorney, and I'm the chair of the Sexually Violent Predator Unit. Our office looked at him. We filed an SVP petition, And he stipulated to the petition at that time and indicated he did meet criteria as a sexually violent predator at that time.
The prosecutor's office filed an SVP petition and some supporting documents on Chris. And in those documents, they say that in 1997, Chris spent some time in a psych ward in Seattle for an evaluation. And during that period, the documents say that he kissed three of the other patients, and then he attempted to engage in mutual genital fondling with one of them. And that after one of the patients was discharged, Chris tried to obtain her address from the staff, and that he admitted to having violent rape fantasies about her and other women. Additionally, the documents say that he disclosed violent and obscure fantasies about having sex with cats and dogs and large sea mammals, and that he fantasized about having sex with body organs, intestines, hearts, and brains. One of the doctors who evaluated Chris wrote, "Christopher clearly presents extremely high risk of sexual assault of younger or vulnerable persons of either sex. Under no circumstances should he return to live with his family now or in the foreseeable future." Christopher was transferred to the Special Commitment Center on McNeil Island when he was 18 years old. And when he was 19, he signed a document stipulating that he was a sexually violent predator.
Our standards are very high for these because we have to rationally differentiate these individuals between your typical sex offender recidivists or typical sex offenders. We do file on less than 1%.
Is civil commitment a valuable tool?
Well, according to the community and the legislature, it is, and we certainly believe it is, and according to the United States Supreme Court, it is.
Washington civil commitment law for sex offenders has been challenged twice in the nation's Supreme Court. SCC residents argued that they were receiving substandard care and that their civil commitment was a form of double jeopardy, that they were essentially serving second prison terms for the same crimes. Both times, the Supreme Court came down in favor of Washington's law.
What's the island like, Chris? What's it like out there?
You know, it's almost claustrophobic. It almost feels like the world is kind of a look but don't touch.
So how old were you when you first decided that you wanted to leave the island?
20, maybe 21. I mean, it was just shortly after I quit treatment because the program was not working.
Court documents written by Chris's attorneys say that shortly after he arrived on the island, Chris stopped taking the psychotropic drugs he'd been on for years. They say that his most severe fantasies cleared up almost immediately. So he stopped going to treatment a year and a half after he got to the island. We emailed with Dr. Holly Coriel, the SCC's head of clinical treatment. We asked her about the therapy offered at the SCC. She told us that residents are offered an average of 5 to 8 hours of sex offender group therapy per week. And she told us that today, about half of the residents participate.
Probably the biggest factor in me changing was my getting off of those drugs, because that cleared up my mind, that allowed me to actually think. It allowed me to get a lot of really, really weird, crazy, and scary thoughts and fantasies out of my head.
Why should anyone believe you when you say you've changed?
In that 19 years, where I'm living in a fishbowl and everything I do is scrutinized, there was no evidence at all that I was deviant. I have absolutely zero interest in committing another sexual offense.
So when someone says they've changed, how do you know whether to believe them? How do you balance the liberty of a single person with the liberty of future victims that may or may not exist? There was a caveat written into the document that Chris signed in the 90s. It stated that someday in the future, Chris would get a chance to challenge his civil commitment in front of a jury of his peers, and that, in that case, the burden of proof would lie upon the state of Washington that they would have to prove that Chris still met the criteria of a sexually violent predator. And if Chris won that case, he'd be released pretty much unconditionally. But if he lost that case, he'd return to stay on the island indefinitely. So, in 2016, Chris got that trial in the King County Superior Court in Seattle. And there, in front of that jury of his peers, the prosecutors began their arguments that Chris was still an SVP, that he was still mentally ill, and that he still posed a threat to society. They pulled no punches in their arguments, and they did not shy away from using graphic descriptions to make their point.
Counsel, ladies and gentlemen of the jury. First time, Mr. was 9 years old, 6 years older than his 3-year-old sister the first time. The first time that he took her out to the shed in the backyard where no one could know what was happening, no one could see what was happening, and no one could hear what was happening. But to be sure, he barricaded the shed door. That's when he pulled down his 3-year-old sister's little panties and fondled her genitalia. And then he pulled out his penis. He made her put it in his mouth and suck on it. That was the first time. There was a second. Then there was a third. There was a 10th, 20th, 50th, a 100th, 200th. And a 300th time. And he's told doctors that he's obsessed with sex.
For the 4 weeks that followed, the jury would sit there in front of Chris all day, no more than 20 feet from him.
I'm not telling you this to shock you or to paint Mr. as a monster. We're telling you this because it's important for you to know the information in this man's past. And the evidence will show you, ladies and gentlemen, that without remorse, without understanding, any insight into his offending, without any social skills, and without any supervision whatsoever, the answer to the question as to whether or not Mr. continues to meet criteria as a sexually violent predator, the answer will be undoubtedly yes. Thank you.
The prosecutors argued that Chris continued to meet the SVP criteria because of his long history of offenses and because he dropped out of treatment shortly after he arrived at the SCC. But Chris's lawyers argued that there's no evidence that Chris has ever been sexually violent towards anyone since his commitment. And they argued that he didn't need to attend therapy because the deviant fantasies that sent him to the island, well, they stopped just after he got there. Each side called expert witnesses. They would come to the stand and argue that, yes, look at Chris's past. Of course he's dangerous. Look at these fantasies that he's had about rape and murder and sex with organs. He hasn't been to treatment in over a decade. He's dangerous. And others would come to the stand and say, no, he's not dangerous. Look, he's changed. Look at his behavior. Look at his attitudes. Look at this test where we put a band around his penis and measure the physical responses to deviant stimuli. Look, he's normal. He's changed.
Doctor, you said you reached an opinion. What is that opinion?
That he is more likely than not to commit acts of sexual violence as a result of his mental abnormality, if not confined to a secure facility.
And is that an opinion to a reasonable degree of psychological certainty?
Yes.
The issue is, though, you have to put it in its proper context, psychologically, psychosocially. It has to be understood in the context in which it occurred. And then you have to make judgments. Okay, is he still that same confused, angry kid that he was back then, now, in 2016? And my answer is, no, he isn't. And he hasn't been for quite some time.
So, when you reviewed the records in 2005, did you make a diagnosis as far as a mental illness or a mental abnormality?
Yes.
And do you recall what that was?
There was pedophilia disorder, paraphilia disorder, indiscriminate object choice, and antisocial personality disorder.
Right. And did you make an assessment as to whether Mr. was at risk for reoffense if not confined in a secure facility?
Yes.
And what was that opinion?
That he was.
He was at risk for reoffense?
Correct.
For 3 weeks, Chris sat silently with his lawyers, observing as a courtroom discussed his sexual history, his darkest fantasies, his emotional capacity, and his temperament. But he hadn't said a word to the jury. And then one afternoon, it was his turn to speak. Andrew Morrison questioned him.
I certainly have you step up onto the witness stand and raise your right hand. Do you swear or affirm the testimony you're about to give is the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth?
Yes, I do.
Please have a seat, sir.
Morrison.
Thank you, Your Honor. Chris, how are you feeling?
I'm feeling all right. A little bit nervous, but just fine.
It's a little hard to introduce a person after we've been talking about them for 3 weeks, so I'm actually just going to begin by asking you some really deeper questions. Can you take a moment to have a few breaths, perhaps? I want to ask you, what is the memory that brings you the most pain when you reflect on it? In all of your life.
I would have to say probably the knowledge that I offended against my sisters.
You are remembering this. What makes this painful? What was the emotion that you're feeling?
Probably the fact that, you know, this is my sister. I should have been, you know, protecting her against, you know, people trying to do what I did. And instead, I was the one doing it. Just no excuse for what I did.
Do you blame yourself for any of this?
Yeah.
Do you ever think about today how the things you did might have affected the lives of those you did them to? How it may have hurt them?
Yeah.
And how often do you think about that?
Every single time that I've heard about my sisters getting into some kind of trouble or, you know, something going wrong, I seem to recall hearing about her, you know, going through several boyfriends. On the one hand, you know, I understand it's, you know, fairly normal, but on the other hand, I can't help but think that, you know, what I did may be part of the reason that a particular relationship didn't work out for her. And I can't help but think that. I have this nagging feeling in the back of my head that what I did is responsible for the problem.
Do you think that'll ever go away?
No.
So when is the last time that you've had sexual thoughts about animals?
I'd say at least 12 years, at least.
What about rape?
Same thing.
What about sexual thoughts regarding children?
I would say once again that those were gone within 4 years of me coming to the SCC. The more outrageous the stuff, the fantasies were, the faster they died off.
What's your reaction to them now?
They scare me, that I actually used to think that I found them interesting. It scares me.
So should people be scared about you being in the community, given that you've had those thoughts in the past? If they scare you, then shouldn't they scare everyone else?
Fantasies like that are almost anathema to me these days. It's so completely repulsive that I wouldn't even be able to conceive of it these days. However, I can understand, you know, people being scared or concerned, because, you know, it is something that was, you know, so outrageous that, you know, I was having back in the day. I can't blame somebody for being, you know, nervous or scared about that. Not at all.
Is there any aspect of your sexuality and your sexual interest that concerns you now?
No.
All in all, the trial went on for about a month. When the jury finally broke for deliberation, they were asked to consider whether the state had demonstrated that Chris still met the definition of a sexually violent predator. Specifically, was he still mentally ill? And if so, does that illness make him more likely than not to reoffend? A ruling in the state's favor would mean Chris's indefinite return to the SCC on McNeil Island. And a ruling against them would mean his nearly immediate and unconditional release back into society.
Rise for the jury.
The jury deliberated for just one day.
And I understand that the jury has reached a verdict without telling you what that verdict is. Is that true?
Yes.
Madam Clerk, please read the verdict in the record.
We, the jury, answer the question submitted by the court as follows. Has the state proved beyond a reasonable doubt that Christopher continues to be a sexually violent predator? Answer, no. Signed by the presiding juror of the state.
The verdict was unanimous against the state, and in just 48 hours, Chris would be released from the island, no longer designated a sexually violent predator.
I felt relieved. I felt like a weight had been taken off of my shoulders. I'm finally able to get out and start and try to build a life.
Do you understand why some people still fear you and maybe even hate you?
Yes, I do.
Back at the ferry dock in Steilacoom, Washington, Bethany and I are standing down by the boat launch, recording the sound of the water and the passing trains. Someone tells us that Chris just got off a barge and is now sitting in a white van with some island staff. We run up to where he is, trying to figure out what's happening.
In this white van here?
The van pulls off and slowly moves towards the parking lot, where there's a man sitting on the back of a black pickup truck.
He has gray hair and gray pants and a black hoodie. He's probably in his late 50s, and he looks a lot like Chris. Bethany runs down with the recorder.
How are you doing today?
Well, I'm pretty excited.
Yeah?
So, that's a gorgeous day for my son to get released on, and good to have him back home.
Chris steps out of the van, and immediately he and his father embrace. Chris and his dad unload his belongings from the van. And Chris mentions that he has to go to the sheriff's office to register as a sex offender. But there's some confusion about exactly when he has to do this. Andrew Morrison and his wife show up to congratulate Chris on his release. And when Andrew hears the conversation, he steps over to help out.
Yeah.
What was their question? Sounded like you were asking me about registration?
Yes.
9:30 on Monday. I got to talk to you about all this stuff. I got my checklist of things for you to be working on. So.
Yeah, they,
As we move through life, right, do we change or are we the same person? Are you just an old version of a child, or do people fundamentally shift and move as they navigate their life?
Is that a serious question? I mean, of course you change throughout your life.
Jennifer Ritchie, the prosecutor from the Sexually Violent Predator Unit, believes that people can change, but she doesn't think that Chris has. So how afraid of Chris should we be?
Well, I think the only person that can keep Christopher from reoffending is Christopher. And in our experience, because of his lack of treatment and because of our experience in seeing his history, the different evaluations, you know, I'm not going to say we should be afraid of Christopher, because I'm certainly not going to, you know, fearmonger about Christopher. But it is keeping our fingers crossed. I mean, I hope to God to never see Christopher again. Because if I see Christopher again, it means that Christopher is taking part in activities that are highly, highly risky behaviors. And, you know, we also know that statistically, a huge number of sex offenses go unreported. So will we know if Christopher reoffends? Unlikely. We will only know if he gets caught. And so, again, I really hope we never see him again.
Human beings need to belong somewhere. You know, stress always comes at us, from minor day-to-day stress to more life-changing, life-altering stress. And the question is, well, how does someone deal with those events in their lives? And there are ways of dealing with it that involve taking your pain out on other people, which is something that drives a lot of sex offending. I think that, you know, in terms of becoming healthy people, what it's really about is learning ways to cope successfully without hurting other people. Human beings are social creatures. There is no one that is an island unto themselves that is better off isolated, who functions better that way. And the further we get away from that, the more unhealthy and the more dangerous we become.
It's hard to tell if Andrew Morrison hoodwinked us into a rosy view of the world of sex offenders. And it's hard to tell if Jennifer Ritchie and other prosecutors did the same by convincing us to be overly afraid of them. And so it leaves Bethany and I at this kind of Rorschach ink blot conclusion, where we're forced to look at the situation in front of us and interpret something from it, something unknowable that lies off in the future. Bethany and I are attempting to be juries of our own. So much of what we heard in the courtroom was about trying to predict Chris's future. Unfortunately, a lot of the data we have on this topic is pretty short term. And further, future recidivism is hard to predict because sex offenses are so often unreported. Pure statistics are a pretty blunt tool, but much of what we know about American sex offenders comes from a large report assembled by the Office of Justice Programs back in 2014. This report shows that sex offenders have significantly lower arrest rates than other kinds of criminals. And the report cites studies that tracked sex offenders 15 years after they were released. And in those 15 years, about one quarter of them had been rearrested for another sexual crime. In 15 years, Chris will be 51.
We'll see you in a few minutes, Chris.
Right. After leaving the ferry dock that day, Chris, his father, Andrew Morrison, and Andrew's wife left to go get lunch. Chris asked for egg rolls, a food that he told us he hasn't had in over 18 years.
Chris was released on the 17th of March, 2016. The SCC's head of clinical treatment, Dr. Holly Coriel, told us that the SCC has unconditionally released a total of 53 residents to date. Another 44 have also been released, but remain under supervision. Mark Strong, the CEO of the Special Commitment Center, declined our request for an interview. And Dr. Coriel was not available within our time frame for an interview. However, she did provide us with a lot of background information, as did Chris's other defense attorney, Christine Sanders, and the two prosecuting attorneys who worked on this case, Allison Bogar and Kristen Richardson. Originally, we had received permission to visit McNeil Island. However, that permission was revoked once Chris was granted his release, so we never did see it up close. But there, plunked in the water like that, the Olympic Mountains on the left and the Cascades on the right, it was a beautiful view. We have photos on our website, hbmpodcast.com. Also on our website, we have a map showing the places in the United States where civil commitment is legal. We also have more information on recidivism rates, sex offender actuarial tools, and the history of sexually violent predator laws. As always, we want to hear from you. Do you think that civil commitment makes society safer? Do you believe that it's a deprivation of rights? Do you live outside the US? If so, what are the laws where you live? You can find us on Facebook and Twitter, or you can email us via the form on our website. Again, we're at hbmpodcast.com. Jeff Emptman produced this episode, along with me, Bethany Denton. Our editor is Nick White. George Lavender fact-checked this episode. Music came from The Black Spot. This is the final episode of our fourth season. We're going to be on a break for a couple months here while we prepare this next season for you. So far, we're looking into topics like self-crucifixion, flesh-eating beetles, real-life vampires, sexual synesthesia, and what happens to dead horses. While we're getting it ready, we encourage you to dig deep into our 25 hours of archived shows. You'll find some strange and beautiful things in there. Also, this summer, while we're on break, we're going to be selling Here Be Monsters stickers for the first time ever on our website. These stickers have our HBM 3D rainbow logo on them, and they're pretty great. Check them out at our store at hbmpodcast.com/store. You may be tired of us saying thank you to you, but Jeff and I can't say it enough. You've been incredibly supportive even as we approach some pretty rough and dark material. But we feel incredibly grateful to make podcasts for people who are just as weird as we are. So thank you for all your thoughtful feedback and episode ideas and criticisms. We love you. Oh, and one last thing. If you're in Seattle, we're close to finalizing the details of our season wrap party. So if you're interested, head over to Facebook and RSVP to the event. Don't worry, the date is still TBD, and we'll let you know just as soon as we get everything set in stone. We hope to see you there. All right, thanks for listening. More episodes soon.